From the Sky News Centre at 6. It's third time unlucky for Theresa May's EU withdrawal agreement. Brexit's been thrown into further crisis, as Tim Jones reports.
The Noes to the left, 344.
The PM lost by 58 votes and warned MPs...
I fear we are reaching the limits of this process in this House.
Labour says if the PM can't secure an alternative Brexit deal, then...
She must go, not at an indeterminate date in the future, but now.
Options include a no-deal scenario or long extension. Outside Parliament, pro-Brexit supporters were furious.
We've been betrayed.
I am beyond frustrated.
EU leaders are to discuss Brexit 2 days before the UK's new April the 12th deadline.
Business leaders have expressed despair at the continued uncertainty. The CBI has described it as a nightmare, while the Federation of Small Businesses says it's a deepening political crisis. In other news, a father who killed his baby son by violently shaking him has been jailed for 15 years. The 30-year-old from Greater Manchester admitted the manslaughter of the four-month-old in an act of deliberate and unlawful violence. A man in his 40s has been stabbed to death outside a tube station in South London. No arrests have been made after police were called to Clapham Common Underground this afternoon. Average house prices in England have recorded their first annual fall since 2012, according to the Nationwide. A typical home's dropped 0.7% in the first 3 months of 2019 compared with the year before. And fans of The Prodigy have travelled from around the world for Keith Flint's funeral in Essex.
Don't know how many times I've seen him, but I've seen him in 34 countries.
I need to be here for him and tell him thank you.
You see today just how popular he was and just how well loved he is.
Festival flags flew and music played over loudspeakers outside the church in Braintree. The singer was found dead at his home this month at the age of 49. That's the latest. I'm Annie Green.
BCFM.
Love Bristol.
Love
BCFM 93.2.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to the Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news as Conservative councillor for Bishopsworth, Richard Eddy, and Labour cabinet member for housing and councillor for Central Ward, Paul Smith. Also with us tonight, that is Sunday Times Rich List journalist Kevin Carhill, and Mick Connolly is a project leader at Stapleton Road's Wild Goose Cafe, providing free meals for Bristol's poor and homeless. After the 7 o'clock news, Martin Summers joins us and we have the latest on the child sex abuse inquiry, with police whistleblowers being ignored. And Margaret Thatcher accused of covering up for her private parliamentary secretary, Sir Peter Morrison, MP. Who apparently was arrested under suspicion of sexually abusing children in 1983, according to papers released by MI5. And is criticising the Rothschilds' code for anti-Semitism continued? Well, we did have a look at that last week, but not more this week. And the Rothschilds' unique place in Jewish culture. Evidence of Nathan Rothschild's making a fortune out of the Battle of Waterloo last week, and Walter Rothschild's drafting the 1917 Balfour Declaration. We look at the family's wealth, exaggerated or otherwise. How easy is it for the super wealthy, the Queen or Jacob Rothschild, to hide their wealth? Why does the Queen languish somewhere at the bottom of the Sunday Times Rich List? She's at 344 and falling. Only £370 million. Jacob has about half of that. Double, sorry. Plus, Christian Zionist hate preachers in the United States. What are they saying to encourage the killing of Muslims? And words of encouragement for Israeli politicians, even, from the Israeli Security Cabinet Moshe Kalon, the secretive finance minister. What does he have to say about Israeli state biblical history and their rights? That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. And tonight, lows around 5 Celsius and dry this weekend. Highs around 16, warming up nicely. Sunny spells tomorrow, cloudy though on Sunday. So ditch the shopping, get out and enjoy the sun tomorrow. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius, plenty of sunny spells, showers towards the end of the week. And next weekend, 6th and 7th of April, highs of 11 Celsius, sunny spells and fleeting showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is Conservative councillor for Bishopsworth, Richard Eddy. Hi, Richard, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Dan.
I think it's one of the first times, isn't it? I haven't had you on for maybe just once a long time ago. Give us your thoughts, first of all, on what's happening. We're supposed to be leaving the European Union today. You haven't delivered that, have you?
Well, clearly, I would agree with most of your listeners. It's been a fiasco, Westminster. But I would say today's vote's actually been good. I approve of that. May is utterly appalling and shoddy deal has been rejected by Parliament, as it should have been.
So why is your leader banging her head against a brick wall then, a third time? And it seemed obvious to most of the country, most of the journalists, that this was never going to work.
Well,
and of course it didn't.
You're probably interviewing the most Eurosceptic Tory in Bristol, so you're not going to get a supportive comment from me for Theresa May. I personally think she's just completely out of her depth and quite incompetent. But there are people like her right-hand man, the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, who I think throughout this process have sought to actually offer the worst possible deal. So, frankly, the British people would balk at the last moment and cancel freedom from Europe.
So is this a whole load of waffle, this Brexit, or the most important moment in British history?
Well, I still believe it's fundamental. It's an issue I've always felt passionately about. I voted for Leave in the referendum, and over two-thirds of my ward voted the same way. Frankly, if we stay in, not only it does demonstrate British interests are subjugated to Europe's, but actually it shows rank contempt for democracy.
Paul Smith, you're a Labour councillor in the city, also on the cabinet looking after housing. Why aren't we leaving today? I mean, it's not your responsibility, but what are your thoughts on what's been happening with the whole Brexit process and where we are now?
Well, I mean, the whole thing's been a farce from the beginning. A referendum to sort out the splits in the Conservative Party and to see off the UKIP in the general election.
But it's more than
instead
that.
Of dealing, because, instead
on,
of dealing with that.
It's more than that, because actually more people turned out to vote in that referendum than anybody in a general election. So there was obviously a need for it. We haven't had that many people turn out, the voter turnout, since I think it's 1992, John Major election. The numbers of people actually bothering to vote has been falling and falling. The referendum was the highest for nearly 20 years or so.
Yeah, it was an extremely high turnout, but it was a false prospectus, that, you know, suggesting to people that it would be as easy to leave the EU as cancelling a telephone contract was just ridiculous, giving people a binary choice on something which, you know, as Richard says, people feel very passionately about. But, you know, up until about a year ago, most people probably had never even heard of the customs union and a lot of the other elements of the EU membership. And, you know, basically, instead of healing the rift in the Tory party, what Cameron did was spread it to the whole of the country. It's split and divided the country. It's created huge animosity.
I'm going to stop you there again because, sorry, this split was there anyway. The referendum just actually expressed that split that was there. It's been there probably since we joined the EU officially in 1975 in the referendum, which was another one. That time it was to remain because we were already in. We didn't get a vote and we stayed in 75. But the country's always been split on this, both the parties actually, your party as well as the Tory party.
Yes, I think we've been split on it since the Battle of Hastings and probably before as a country, and we probably will be. But the answer to that was not to expose that sore and give people the belief that they could change things easily through just putting an X on a ballot paper. It's much, much more complicated than that.
So what is Labour going to do? What would Labour do? Because all you seem to be doing is voting no to everything.
Well, as you said, there are different views within the Labour Party. I think we should revoke the thing and stop pretending that it's something that's easy to do. That's not the Labour Party front bench view. The Labour Party's view is to go for a second referendum. I've tended to be against that on the basis I think referenda are a very bad way of making public policy, and doesn't fit with our representative democracy. However, it's increasingly looking like that's the only way we're going to actually break the impasse here. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if there wasn't a second referendum or a third referendum, as some people would say.
Okay, well, one thing people, almost everyone has agreed, is they want this out of the way and finished one way or the other and done with, because a lot of the other issues that are affecting society, education, welfare benefits, things like that, a lot of this is suffering because it's not being considered by a government which is obsessed with Brexit. It seems to be the only thing on the table.
Good argument for revoking it.
Well, maybe. But yeah. What are your thoughts about whether or not Brexit will make any difference to those people that Mick Colony here looks after, that is to say the poorest people in the city? And as Mick will say in a minute, I'm sure, many of those people are working people that just simply cannot afford to put food on the table. These are much more important issues in many ways than Brexit. How do you think Brexit, one way or another, might affect those people?
Well, to be honest, I'm not sure it will have a great impact. The welfare benefit changes, which priced lots of people out of the housing market with the implementation of the local housing allowance, happened under the European Union. It could continue after membership of the European Union. You know, the problem there is from our domestic policy. And those that think that everything has to come back to Europe, like, for instance, the new Change UK party, I think are wrong. I don't think Brexit is the only issue.
So you think it's probably not going to have any effect?
For those people? No, I don't think it is. I think there are much bigger issues that affect, you know, those who are absolutely in destitution, as the people who are on the streets and the people that Mick serves are. But it's certainly not going to make things any better for them.
Richard, what are your thoughts about? Is Brexit going to make any difference for the people who have been marginalised in society, forgotten about, don't have an income, or if they do, they can't use that income to put food on the table for their kids?
I would hope it would, because clearly, frankly, tens of millions of pounds are being sorted out, paid over to the EU. Even if Theresa May still went through, that would still be the case. We do it, pay it in a divorce bill. This is money which, frankly, we can decide as Britons how it's spent, hopefully not on bureaucracy, but on frontline services which meet local need.
Do you think there'd be a temptation to spend it on something like a new aircraft carrier or something instead of the poor?
Yes, there will be multiple, like we have with the councils. You always have demands for this and that. Mm. But the point is, it would be our decision what to spend it on, not actually bureaucrats in Brussels.
Okay, Kevin Carhill, former Sunday Times journalist. What do you make of this question, particularly this question about what is going to be the actual effect on the people who are being most adversely affected by austerity and the massive reining back of public spending we've seen since 2010?
Their situation will simply get much worse, partly because of the money that's being spent on this so-called divorce settlement. But I'd like to take Richard up on one thing. I had to deal with Brussels for years, one-to-one, and this pawning everything off on bureaucrats in Brussels, yes, they are dreadful, but the worst bureaucrats I've ever met are the ones in Whitehall, specifically the Home Office, which seems to be full of, well, we can't say it.
Okay, so what is just describe the character of a Brussels bureaucrat and the character of a Whitehall bureaucrat. How are they different, Kevin?
The Brussels bureaucrats are better paid and they're more sophisticated and they get more out of it because their salaries are inflated. Bureaucrats in Whitehall tend to be ignorant of the law, particularly the Home Office. The Home Office's Windrush has been a complete catalogue of crime. You know, and this is the government ministry supposed to deal with justice. You know, it's... So the Brussels bureaucrats are more sophisticated. Ours are less sophisticated, but they're worse.
Okay, so before... some sort of alarm going off in here. I'll tell you what we'll do is we'll go and speak now to Mick Connolly from the Stapleton Rose Wild Goose Cafe, who provides free meals for Bristol's poor. And when I was chatting to you on the phone, Mick, you made the point to me, actually, increasingly what we're seeing coming to the Wild Goose are people who are in work but just simply can't afford to put food on the table. So can you just run us through, I suppose, what you do and ultimately what you think the solutions are?
Yeah, so we provide a drop-in cafe, providing hot meals, breakfast, lunch and evening meals, clothes and advice and support for people that are coming in who are homeless, but also people that are actually in accommodation but they're not able to meet their basic needs. So we offer them a support on a day-to-day basis,
So is it every day of the week? Every evening?
5 days a week, 6 nights a week.
So which night do you not do?
Saturday night we are closed, basically. Okay. So it's...
And what about numbers? How many meals are you providing, and how does that compare to, say, 10 years ago or something?
So obviously the demand, and it's been an increase in kind of homelessness. I've got some numbers here in terms of sessions of listening and signposting to other services. It's 652 sessions annually. 352...
When you say 652 sessions, what does that mean?
So that's members of staff and volunteers sitting down with people that are coming through the door and supporting them and offering them advice and kind of ways to address some of the issues that they're facing.
This is on top of the meals?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is great. So as people come in looking for meals, if they need a little bit more help to maybe navigate their way through the housing system or whatever it is, it may be substance abuse, something like that, you're able to help with that too.
Yeah, we're able to signpost and redirect to different services. We've also got a doctor that comes in once a week and is able to meet with people and look at their health needs. Also a nurse that comes in on a Thursday for the fallout of who the doctor doesn't see as well. So we've got a range of different professionals coming in, kind of outreach teams as well, to support them. Just in terms of like items of like clothing, we give something like 450 items of clothing out. 470 volunteers work with us annually. 368 sessions of telephone and computer use, and that's part of the support that they get from staff. 81 sleeping bags are given out. 39 referrals to other services. 129 loads of kind of laundry that staff wash and dry and then give back out. 17 advice sessions regarding housing and benefits. 36 volunteer shifts from local businesses. So we get local businesses getting involved and coming in and volunteering and supporting us as well.
What about solutions, though? I mean, you see these people every day. You must have thoughts yourself, well, why on earth doesn't either the city council or central government do X, Y, and Z? Or why doesn't, you may have other ideas about other people who should be doing things.
I think, obviously, local services are stretched, right across the board. Everyone's doing as much as they possibly can. In the last 5 years, I've worked in supported housing. I'm a strong believer of, people going into supported housing and stabilising and, learning about social independent living skills and stuff.
Well, some
like will
that. Say, from street people going on into supported housing, sometimes they're in the supported housing. They're being exposed to hard drugs and being exposed to violence, all sorts.
Obviously, you will do a bit of prep work before people are going into supported housing. You can, it's really about getting the right people in supported housing, supporting them through that pathway and on into permanent accommodation as well.
What about the roots of the problems, though? Because, I would imagine if you were sitting here, say, 40 years ago, many of those people would have been housed by the city council, given a flat or something, and also that the benefit system was completely different, really, that there wasn't this hard attitude towards if someone doesn't turn up at a certain time, they get all their money taken away, and then they have to either beg or go to organised crime in order to try and make a living, get enough money just to feed themselves, etc.
I think that obviously the changes in with welfare and reform, universal credit, the timeframes for when people are getting the benefits also impacts, you know, on people being able to meet their bills and, you know, as I say, live on a day-to-day basis, getting what food they need contributes to all of that. I think there's more can be done locally, but, you know, I haven't got all of the solutions. It's easy to say, oh, you're not, basically, because you're drinking and kind of using drugs, we're not going to help you. But it's, I mean, not.
Some might say, well, there should be, you know, there needs to be more jobs for people. But then some of the people you're seeing wouldn't necessarily be able to hold down a job, even if the jobs were there.
I think there's more need for specialist services to come into play, you know, to meet people's needs in terms of their complexities.
But at the same time, we're seeing less and less of this. We're seeing cuts all the time to these services. Mm.
I haven't got the answers for that. It's really more about local authority kind of coming up with more solutions, basically.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's over to a man who's on the cabinet here in Bristol City Council. You're spending £350 million of our money every year, Paul, amongst other people. but the cabinet is, I mean, effectively the council is.
Spends about £1 billion a year. That's the net amount from in the general fund. So it's much more than that spent.
Okay, so what do you make of what you've heard here? You know, massively increasing loan on a voluntary organisation, doing stuff that the council, much of which the council used to do, and you're just not doing it anymore.
Well, actually, last year our services that we commissioned dealt with or supported 951 street homeless people. The year before that, it was 773. So the number of people coming onto the streets from Bristol and from outside of Bristol is increasing massively.
Well, when you say supporting, what do you mean?
Well, it means it can mean a range of things. It can be moving people into accommodation. It can be helping them with getting work. It could be helping them with housing advice, benefits advice. But that's a total number of people. I mean, providing them with a cup of coffee. It's a whole range of things that our outreach services do.
Well, they need more than that, don't they? They really, number one, generally need a roof over their head.
But the roof over the head is only one element. So firstly, they need to be able to keep that roof over their head. There's no point putting them into somewhere and then a few months later they're back out again because you haven't given them the survival skills to live in a property, that they haven't got an income that allows them to stay in that property. So it's very simplistic to say what they need is housing. Actually, very often what people need is a lot of support. I mean, I was listening today to one of the largest homelessness organisations, they saying 85% of the people who come through their doors have had some form of severe childhood trauma, you know, whether that, you know, abuse within the family or some other problem. And actually, to deal with the roots of the problem, as well as reversing the benefit for reforms that have priced people out of housing, you also need to deal with the services that are available for people when they're young children and they're living in chaotic instances.
Are you doing that?
Well,
can you afford to do it?
We obviously, you know, most of the money that we spend as a council goes on social services, and children's social services is a large part of that. But the amount of money that's been available to the council on that has become less and less. We also know the same is true of the mental health services, which also either support the families or the children. And if you keep pulling out resources from the social sector, you end up with bigger problems down the line. So we've kept the children's centres open in Bristol, but open at a much lower level of provision than was the case before, because of the way money's gone.
Richard, I mean, I have to ask you really about the Conservative Party centrally, because the 2010 government of David Cameron started to bring in all these cuts that Paul's been describing there, the pot that they're able to use. And you would be, were you in the ruling party in the city or mayor, would have to, they're coping with a smaller and smaller pie all the time to spend on these services. Hence, Mick and people like him are having to pick up the tab, effectively.
I think there are two issues there. There's no doubt, even when relatively things were good for public finances in the 90s and early noughties, I mean, Labour was spending money as if it was water, and we're living with the really severe consequences of repaying debt for that. at least we're repaying debt, not actually paying more in interest.
Hang on, because that's not true, is it? Because the national debt is increasing.
Can I just move on?
The national debt is increasing,
I'm not
Richard.
Just going to spend too time on macroeconomics. I have to say, Paul knows I do probably, and it pains me, agree with some of his points. I was thoroughly opposed to the Cameron's housing so-called reforms, which in my view were stupidly driven and would actually make a bad situation infinitely worse. So I'm pleased. I don't have an awful lot of good to say about the present government, but I'm glad she seems to have changed tact vis-a-vis housing, for example.
Well, so you're painting quite a positive picture there in a way, Richard. Mick, do you see things getting better at all?
Not at the moment, no. We are seeing more and more of the same people coming through the door. We obviously send people to outreach teams, they do work with them, but it's a constant revolving door of the same people.
Paul mentioned mental health there. Is this something you increasingly see problems with, and are you able to help people with any kind of sort of mental health referral when they're actually probably on the streets because they're mentally ill, that being the main issue, that they just cannot get their life together in order to get job, you know, hold down a job, that sort of thing?
For people like that, we obviously work with specialist services as well. We've not got trained staff in mental health. We can support them in the best possible way we can. But we're kind of holding people, in a sense, to get them to the services that they need as well.
Okay, so can you just tell us if people are interested in either volunteering or need something to eat, whereabouts to find you?
So we're on the bottom of Stapleton Road. The Wild Goose, you can't miss us. It's a renovated pub. We're currently we've got a campaign to spruce the Goose, basically. We've been using the same place for the last 8 years, and you could imagine that we've had a lot of people go through the service. So we're trying to raise £150,000. We are currently, last I found out today, halfway there. So you cannot miss us, basically. You'll probably see a gathering of people outside.
Okay, meal times are when? When you actually open?
Meal times 10:30 till 3 p.m. and then 8 o'clock till 9:45 on an evening.
Mick Connolly, project leader at the Wild Goose Cafe. It's also part of something called Crisis Centre Ministries, isn't it? What's the relationship between the cafe and the ministry? This is a church organisation of some sort.
Yeah, so 30 years ago, a Christian group was going out in the street helping people, homeless people, and a priest went along with him on that day and bumped into a person who basically asked him, "What can you do for me?" And since that conversation, that priest went back to the churches, and crisis centres has originated from that and grew basically. And we not only provide the cafe, we provide a women's night shelter, we provide a life recovery group that kind of helps people in addictions, and we also got East Bristol Food Bank that provides food to families in need.
Well, Mick Connolly, more power to your elbow. Thanks very much for joining us here on the Politics Show. Kevin, I'll ask you, I suppose, this one about, I suppose, the one of the main problems here is that you've got people who simply can't cope with life. This is why I brought up mental health with Mick then, is that for a lot of people, they simply cannot manage to hold down a flat, hold down a job, and in the meantime, the austerity and the government cuts are meaning that the sorts of services that would have been provided to them aren't anymore.
Well, there's a couple of places. Mick over there meets ordinary people on the street, you know, not able to cope. There are there's one other big issue, prison, the prison system. A lot of people are in prison who have mental health problems, and it's, you know, the ideological policies of both Labour and the Tories, neither of them work from figures. They dream up solutions in Whitehall. And down on the street, you get people. The solution is you click in on your PC. Most of the people on the street are in badly paid, haven't got a PC. A lot of them no longer have telephones. And then they come into a benefit office, and they're told they have to make appointments on PCs and so on. This is what happens when ideology, and it's common to Labour and Tory, when ideology decides what happens instead of the facts. Both parties are hyper-delinquent in terms of not addressing facts or having facts. They just dream up solutions. I've watched them do it in Whitehall.
Now, the former South Bristol MP, Tony Benn, Paul, quite a long time ago, I remember him hearing him saying, oh, well, we've got to, and this is in the first years of the 1980s, in the Thatcher era, when we first started seeing people regularly begging on the streets in London. Mm. I can remember my first trip being quite shocked to see, gosh, we've got people begging in London now. Mm. And what Tony Benn had to say about it was that this is actually sends quite an important message out. There is a purpose to this, that everybody then, as they see those people on the streets, they think, well, I must be very disciplined about my finances. I must keep my job, otherwise I could end up like that. And it sends a message to people, a fearful message, that you better not step out of line or you'll end up like this. And that, Would you agree with that? What he said about that? Or do you think there is a sort of cynical purpose in trying to keep people on the street sometimes?
Within the British establishment, there is a leftover from the 18th century. And the situation on the streets, we are back to Victorian Britain that I wrote about. And the situation is quite possibly worse.
What did you write about it? How do you mean?
In the land book.
Who
owns Britain? A lot of the land book was about rural poverty. And we've now got urban and rural poverty. And we've got people in Whitehall dreaming up solutions behind desks. Solutions very often that they don't test. You know, what is it really like?
Sounds like the ivory tower way of government. Anyway, Paul Smith, Labour councillor, what do you make of this? Kevin's been saying there, and generally about Tony Benn's thoughts, which were, well, actually, there is a purpose to this kind of Victorian way of doing things, is that it keeps everybody in line.
Well, I don't want to be accused of being ideological. I would hope that that's not the case. I think a lot of it is the unforeseen consequences of short-term financial measures, like, for instance, the introduction of the local housing allowance, which has forced huge numbers of people into homelessness. You've got to remember, you know, that there's been some work done that says 3% of the people who are homeless in Bristol are on the streets. That means 97% of the homeless aren't. We're currently accommodating over 500 families with children in temporary accommodation. There are over 100 people living in vehicles. There are 1,200 people living in our supported hostels. There are over 100 people living in homeless shelters. And so what you see on the streets is not homelessness. It's a very extreme end of destitution. And which is, I would say, an inevitable consequence of a political ideology which says, if you don't get on, it's your own fault, and we will punish you for it by withdrawing your benefits or making life incredibly difficult for you. So I do think, you know, the problem that we've got is ideologically driven. Also, you know, we've had this discussion before. You know, in Bristol, we used to have 48,000 council homes. We've now got 27,000 council homes. Those haven't been replaced through the housing associations or other sectors. And we need a huge increase in social housing so that people on low incomes, and particularly people who work on low incomes.
Okay, so you're in charge now. Are you delivering that?
Yeah, so we've got a pipeline of over 800 council homes at the moment, which we're
involved
in.
How long is the pipeline going to take to chug out with these 800
homes? Well, we're building
homes.
You know, there's
10 years?
There's some of them will be finished in the next few months. There's over about 200 of them are on site and being built at the moment. So they are coming through the system. We expect, in terms of affordable housing in total this year, about 500, which will be the highest figure certainly for over a decade. So it's starting to change, but on its own, it's not enough. If you've got a punitive benefit system, you will still have people, particularly people with chaotic lifestyles who, you know, have suffered a lot through their life, finding themselves unable to cope with a bureaucracy which is unable for them to deal with, including so,
let's just move on to Richard. By default. Richard, what do you make of this? Because it does seem as if this whole universal credit policy and the benefit sanctions is an attempt to it's the stick approach. It's not the carrot approach. And using a stick on people who are already quite vulnerable is simply it's unlikely to work. Well, and I suppose Kevin's saying there too, cruel.
It's just plainly cruel.
Well, one of the things Kevin said which struck home with me was actually how we're effectively disenfranchising these people, making it even more difficult to sort things out. For example, for most of my political life, I represented most of Withywood. I still do the Highridge Council estate. Last night I was at Housing Forum in Hartcliffe. People I represent, sadly, and a large number of councillors of all political hues actually have people who have real problems actually emailing, ringing appropriately and getting an answer in less than half an hour or so. And I know Paul, I think, is doing, and I don't want to make his head any bigger, a good job in difficult circumstances. But the council closed because of, budget cuts. Various area offices in the last couple of years. And in key areas, they were the key way of actually meeting local people where they lived, of course. And that's a great loss.
Those benefit sanctions don't work unless work is a route out of poverty. And what we've been hearing from Mick earlier is that people are getting jobs, but they're still not able to feed their families. So it's not a route out of poverty. How are we going to fix that one?
There are two ways, because frankly, I'll use the example I know best, South Bristol. I mean, in some cases, in some communities, we have not one, not two, but three generations of people who've been jobless. So obviously, they depended on benefits and things, and that's impacted upon their education or their skills, chances, etc., their confidence. And it's not a wonder that we're suddenly strike a switch that it will work. We have to put all the strategies, all the work in place to actually provide hope, skills, education. The council, is providing more apprenticeships. We need to go ahead with private sector employers in Bristol, which we are.
Unfortunately, what's happened is, nationally, we've seen a sort of attitude which is, let's starve people into low-paid work. So it doesn't actually lift them out of poverty, but it does reduce the amount of benefits that the government pays them. And we've actually seen people's incomes drop in as they go into work,
except
rather than increasing.
Except at the top, their incomes are massively increasing, aren't they?
I mean, it's interesting talking about the Sunday Times Rich List, because all the time when we were seeing that wages were falling, that the number of billionaires on the Sunday Times Rich List was going up.
Well, all those billionaires are pushing the Queen down the witch list. I'm not sure I should say that, witch list. Anyway. Anyway, so let's go back to full council meeting, local politics here, because last week we had a fascinating full council meeting. Well, I call it fascinating. And very important issue, which is the state of our air that we breathe here in Bristol, which was the beginning of the problems, it seems, at down at the Bear Pit, a big advertising hoarding saying, look, we've got to sort this one out, giving an estimated Friends of the Earth estimated number of deaths that have been caused by air pollution in the city. And so finally, some doctors from the National Health Service here in the city brought a petition to be heard by Mayor Marvin Rees last week's council meeting. And here is one of those doctors now.
Bristol Council is right to be concerned about the affordability of a clean air zone for its citizens. However, the Mayor's primary concern must be the devastating cost of air pollution to human health. We would like to know how the inaction on cleaning up our air is justified and what equality-focused measures the Mayor is considering alongside the clean air zone to mitigate its costs for those who can least afford them, are contributing least to the problem and who are suffering the most.
Well, the Labour Mayor, Marvin Rees, went on to explain that actually there's quite a lot going on behind the scenes to get air quality improved in the city. But then, surprisingly, he launched into what I can only describe was a bit of a tirade against the National Health Service, who he said were actually causing air pollution in the city.
The NHS generates 5% of all road journeys in this country, OK? So this is on NHS's own numbers. All right, they contribute 735 deaths from air pollution. They cost us 8,844 life years, contribute to 85 deaths and 772 major injuries, and they create £650 million for demand on NHS services. So I would say, as an NHS professional, what would also be good is don't wait for the council. The NHS is a massive institution. It's a sovereign body. Look at your own transport plans. I'll be interested to know what's been going on inside the NHS, what you're doing around transport plans to take the burden you bring onto our roads. And I would also be interested to know what you're doing to ensure that the NHS is transferring all of its diesel vehicles over into electric or biogas.
So I'll come to you first on this, Paul Smith. As someone that sits regularly with the Mayor, Marvin Rees, maybe you can probe his mind for us. Why is it that he's blaming the National Health Service there for air pollution here in Bristol, where actually it's something that he is supposed to be dealing with?
He was, I think, quoting some national figures. I'm not sure all those figures are correct. I've looked on the NHS website and it says the NHS is responsible for 3.5% of all road journeys. But what it says is that a lot of that is actually by the patients rather than by the NHS itself. And the website also makes it clear that the NHS is moving its vehicles over to low emission vehicles. I think there is an issue. There's a difference between the people who run the NHS, who are senior civil servants and senior figures within the NHS, and GPs are obviously providing health services to people within the city. And I think it's right for GPs to raise concerns they have about the health of their patients.
But it seems to me like bullying. The person that's raising the issue and is actually an expert, you're saying it's your fault. This, not my fault. Richard, what do you make of this?
Well, firstly, I would say, frankly, that's a wider issue. That one way we can hold the mayor to account is by questioning him. And perhaps councillors can, are they big enough and ugly enough to be attacked? But the mayor seems to want to attack members of the public, the NHS here, Stokes Croft campaigners, Stokes Lodge campaigners. He's also, I would say, frankly, we're on very dodgy grounds. Only a couple of weeks ago, we turned down a new transport hub for the BRI. At the moment, far too many people have to drive there and circle around trying to find a parking place, pumping out pollution. This was a way which, sadly, Labour and Green councillors stopped, where we could adopt redress it.
Paul, can you just talk about that hub, the BRI?
The BRI wanted to build a large multi-storey car park on its site. Which
at that point, Richard has to leave us. Yeah,
which didn't really fit with any of the transport strategies of the city. It breached 23 of our planning policies, which is an amazing feat, as well as national planning policy as well. So I think the planning committee really had no option other than to turn it down. They were also planning to demolish 36 key worker homes, which employees of the NHS live in. So The proposal from the Health Trust was beyond bizarre. We've asked them to come and talk to us. We think that there can be a solution that's found to that. We know that they've got over 300 car parking spaces, which are not available to their patients to use.
When are you going to do a congestion charge and stop people coming into the city in their cars then?
Well, as you know, I'm responsible for housing, not transport policy. You should get Kai Dudd on
here. I'm asking you, do you know about it?
I'm not aware of any proposals for a universal congestion charge within Bristol at the moment. I do know that, you know, in terms of dealing with air pollution, there are plans particularly to deal with HGVs and large diesel vehicles that come into the city and which do cause a large amount of pollution. We're also talking to the government about support for a sort of scrappage or conversion scheme for polluting diesel vehicles.
But the thing is, this is a regressive tax, Paul, isn't it? It hits the poor people. Rich people don't even care about congestion.
Not many poor people drive HGVs. And they certainly don't pay the fees that that their operators would. So we're looking at businesses. We're looking at businesses around the poor people, but also what we have to remember is that we're moving towards. You know, we tend to be trying to solve the future problems by looking at the past, in the sense that actually we're moving towards far more vehicles being electric and not polluting at all.
Okay, now let's have a listen to a bit more from the full council meeting. And this was this is especially for you, Kevin Carhill, because this is all about Stoke Lodge and whether a fence is a structure, which did seem to amuse quite a lot of people in the public gallery at the council meeting. And it starts with, I believe it's one of the campaigners from We Love Stoke Lodge talking to Labour Mayor Marvin Rees, and actually what had happened was that they weren't really supposed to be debating it because the council legal advice said that because there was some other legal action going on, they probably shouldn't be talking about it. But anyway, they did anyway, and this is what they a little clip from what they said.
I've seen people come together across bigger divides in the world.
I have brought for you tonight a copy of the lease, and I've highlighted the relevant phrase for you. The lease between Cotton School and the Council for Stoke Lodge Painfields prohibits the erection of any buildings or other structures at Stoke Lodge. Consent from BCC is completely irrelevant. It would require a deed of variation, and there isn't one of those. So, my question is, does it surprise you that your officers apparently think that for some reason unknown to normal English usage, a 1.5 kilometre long, 2 metre high metal fence that's concreted into the ground is not a structure?
Yeah, I mean, the team have taken legal advice and it's deemed not to be a structure. I mean, I honestly come back. What I'm saying is, okay, one is about the approach. All right. We talked about the need to be able to sit around the table with people and have a conversation. If the culture has gone to that, whereby when I just inform you that the legal advice received by our officers said that the fence is not deemed to be a structure. All right.
On a point of order, why am I being denied confidentially to see that council's advice? As a ward councillor, I've been denied it. I have written and said I promise to sign a form that I will keep it totally confidential, but I've still been denied it. You're gagging us.
So that was from last week's full council meeting. Stoke Lodge campaigners and the mayor basically saying, well, I don't have to tell you what my legal advice is, but a fence is not a structure and we don't need to alter the lease.
No, that is completely wrong. The precedents in common law are that a fence divides a property or properties. And a fence is, in precedent, a structure. It can depend a bit on what kind of, you know, a one-wire fence, you might be able to talk it out. But if you're talking about what they're talking about, that is a structure in English law.
Paul, why is it that Marvin doesn't want to share this legal advice? Is that normal? Because it would have thought that anything that just doesn't sound logical needs to be shared in order for him to be publicly accountable about the decisions he's making.
I mean, sometimes when you get legal advice, that legal advice includes, you know, how public or not you can make it. It does seem to me, though, that it might take some of the sting out of this issue if the local ward councillors could see the legal advice that's been received. I don't know the reason for why that's been kept from them. I must admit that not speaking on this issue particularly, but in terms of legal advice generally, is that sometimes you get the legal advice you ask for. So, you know, most people, when they go to a lawyer, they don't say, is this right or wrong? They say, how within the law can I do X? And that's certain, you know, I've had to use the law sometimes.
Or maybe in public life, and if you're not getting the legal advice you like from your lawyers, you might decide you want to.
Well, I actually had to do that. I mean, on one of the things I wanted to do within housing, our in-house lawyers said that it would not be legal to do it. I knew other councils were doing it, so unfortunately I had to pay a fee to go outside to get the legal advice to tell me I could do something that I knew I could do, but which my internal lawyers were telling me I couldn't.
So it's just an opinion, really.
This is one of the obvious reasons why people try and hide legal advice, usually because it's wrong. And in this case, Tony, it sounds as if the advice is wrong. They're trying to say a substantial structure is not a a fence is not a structure. I'm sure that legal advice was different. It probably did.
I mean, what was it about with wider issues, Paul Smith? I mean, it's not really. This is city council land, public land, and surely there is a case for it being shared with local people, particularly when there's nowhere else for them to go, and Cotton School. But even Ofsted apparently have said that Cotton School can share the land. It's not a problem for Ofsted. So why is it that the local people are being shut out? There's obviously lots and lots, massive strength of feeling with hundreds, if not thousands, of people in the area starting to get rather irritated.
I mean, it's very difficult for me to comment on legal advice, which I haven't seen either. So I don't know what that legal advice is and what it says about its confidentiality. But if I was the ward councillor in Peter Abraham's position, I would probably be very keen to see it myself too.
Kevin, what about this sort of process? Is there anything that you can advise locals to do in order to actually retain access to this park?
The basic thing is to get, when somebody is hiding something and bringing in confidentiality over the disposal of property, usually they're trying to hide something that is wrong. So the first thing is insist on seeing the advice and then most solicitors do conveyancing and they know the basic rules about fences and structures. It should be very easy to establish that a fence is a structure, unless it's a single piece of wire or something.
Well, another piece of news this week. It's amazing. Central government are doing some things that aren't Brexit. MPs vote for LGBT inclusive sex and relationship education from primary schools. It's the first time relationship education guidance has been changed since 2000. MPs voted in favour of this. 538 MPs backed the proposal brought by Education Secretary Damien Hines, which will mean children are taught about different family models from primary school. 21 MPs opposed the measure. The controversy here, Paul Smith, is that the sex education lessons have been generally have been done with secondary age kids after age 11, after sexual maturity. This is now sort of going to primary school children. A lot of parents are not happy about it, particularly, I suppose, the main argument being used here is that as children start to discover their sexuality, they're being told actually there's no difference between whether you are like same-sex people or opposite-sex people, and that isn't necessarily what parents want their children to be taught.
Yeah, well, I think you've summed it up. I don't know what you're asking me.
I'm just asking what you think of whether this is a good thing to have in primary schools. A lot of parents are actually, there's been demonstrations here in Bristol a few years ago and in other parts of the country, parents saying, well, we're not going to allow our kids to go to school if they're going to teach them this. It's not appropriate at that age.
I'm not sure that there is a particular age. I think at any age, we shouldn't be telling children that certain sort of relationships which we've agreed in law are perfectly reasonable and normal are not normal. And therefore, children should be exposed to the fact that you can have same-sex relationships as well as heterosexual relationships. I don't think that's about talking to them about sex. It's talking to them about relationships and the way in which people come together. And I think confusing the issue of what sort of relationships can people form within our country with the issue of sex is probably where the problem lies.
Well, what do you make of this?
There's a very rigid religions like Catholicism wouldn't tolerate that because Catholicism is very rigid. You know, the only relationships allowed are heterosexual and et cetera. And then we have the problem with the Muslim community, which would be very similar, oddly, to the Catholic community. They have quite rigid rules about what's right and wrong sexually. So you're going to run into problems with any community or group of people of a strong religious.
Is it confusing for primary age kids to be exposed to these sorts of ideas when they're, you know, before they would normally in the previous system be only getting sex education once they get to secondary school?
It's a tricky one, and I don't think it's easy to solve by bureaucratic rules.
I don't think it's sex education, it's relationship education. You've got to remember, some of the children in primary schools will have same-sex parents, and they should feel that they have as much a right to their existence and that their family situation is as normal as anybody else's. And I think we should get away from this being about sex education to it being about people forming healthy relationships with other people.
No, that's it's a thought I would support totally. It's a lovely thought, and it's the right way to go. But like I said, there are groups in our communities who are totally sincere about their religious beliefs.
Well, anyway, the next story may be related, maybe not. It's about conservative Islamophobic MPs. And this came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Afzal Khan!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This weekend, The Guardian reported that 15 Tory councillors who were suspended for Islamophobia or racism had been quietly reinstated. The Conservative Party has so far failed to quell fears that they are in denial about Islamophobia. Since I asked the Prime Minister about this in June 2018, there has been no concrete action. Will the Prime Minister instruct her party chairman to respond to the 3 letters I've sent him on this subject? And when will the Tory party adopt the APPG British Muslims definition of Islamophobia? Has the Labour Party, the Lib Dems, Plaid Cymru, the Mayor of London and councils across the country have done?
Yeah. Prime Minister!
The Honourable Gentleman, that the Conservative Party has a complaints process which deals with complaints of Islamophobia and complaints of any other sort against councillors or other members of the party. It is absolutely clear that discrimination or abuse of any kind is wrong. We take action against where there are cases of discrimination or abuse. He says we haven't acted since, I think, 2018 when he raised this issue. We have acted on cases that any allegations that are brought before the party chairman takes this very seriously, and we will continue to do so.
What do you make of the Conservatives not or reinstating Islamophobic MPs and members, or not MPs, members?
I think in terms of any sort of racism or any other sorts of discrimination, all parties should have zero tolerance of it. That's my party, Conservative Party, Lib Dems, anybody else.
Time for the US-owned Comcast News at 7. Thanks to our guest, Conservative Councillor for Bishopsworth, Richard Eddy. And you just heard there, Labour Cabinet Member for Housing, Councillor for Central, Paul Smith. Also from Kevin Carhill and Mick Connolly. Join us after the US-owned Comcast News.
Live from the Sky News Centre.